Welcome to Nerds at Church, a queer feminist podcast diving deep into faith, nerdery, and the Bible. I'm Pastor Kay, and I use pronouns like she and her.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and my pronouns are they, them, their. In this episode, we'll discuss male astronomers. I know, they do exist.
Mm-hmm. Check out the episode description for links to any references we make in this episode.
Now, obviously, we already covered the most important astronomers last week in our episode on astronomers, but we also thought it was important to make sure that male astronomers get some amount of shared knowledge. So we're going to dive into male astronomers this week. But before we get to the male astronomers, it was brought to our attention that we missed Hypatia last week when we were doing the real astronomers. So here's some information about Hypatia.
Hypatia was born in the mid-300s, somewhere between 350 and 370. We're not sure about an exact date. And she died in 415 in the Common Era. And she was an astronomer, mathematician, and a philosopher. And among other works, she is now believed to have added to and edited the version of Ptolemy's Almagest that survives today, which was an astronomical and mathematical work that sort of solidified the geocentric model of the universe for several centuries, basically, and remained a classic of the genre for generations. She died when she was murdered by a Christian due to political rumors that are kind of complicated, despite the fact that she, being a pagan, had willingly taught Christians for several years, which was absolutely not always the norm in that time and place. And the reaction to her murder worsened the position of Christians in that area for many years, proving that indeed murder bad.
Indeed, indeed. Murder is bad.
Yeah.
And that's Claudius Ptolemy for folks.
Yeah, yeah. And so let's jump into some historical male astronomers, shall we? First up, we have Hipparchus, who was born sometime around 190 and died around sometime 120-ish before Common Era. And he was known as one of the greatest male astronomers of antiquity. It's unknown if he was married or had children, but he did prove that the axis of the Earth is tilted and rotates due to his calculations regarding how the equinox dates change over time. And he also created very accurate models of the size of the sun and moon with the help of other male astronomers' work. And he created the first known star catalog. He may have invented the astrolabe, but we're not actually sure who invented that. It's commonly attributed to him. And he also, like I said, was a mathematician and basically created most of trigonometry.
I think mostly in the Western world, because there are some astronomers who we will talk about who also were really big in creating some of the fundamentals of trigonometry.
Yeah.
Some of the male astronomers that we talk about.
Yes, but I think that those astronomers are actually significantly later on by like several hundred years.
Okay, that's fair. I don't know that they knew about each other, but that is
that's a good point.
Our next male astronomer is Aryabhata I, who was born in about 476 CE in Kusumapura, which is in what is now known as Patna, India, and likely studied in Kusumapura for his academic studies. Do we need to introduce, or is this the same?
Oh.
Is this the same one as last week or a different one?
Our guest today, again, is Hobbes, who is named after a philosopher, not an astronomer. Well, and also, you know, a stuffed tiger. But he is very happy to be here.
I was like, he was not named after...
Well, the stuffed tiger was named after the philosopher, and the cat is named after the stuffed tiger.
That's fair.
So his ancestral name is a philosopher.
Welcome, Hobbes. It's good to have you back. So Aryabhata was the first of the major male mathematician astronomers from the classical age of Indian mathematics and astronomy, plus a little bit of physics, hat tip to his theory of relativity of motion and his work in that. And a lot of what we have about Aryabhata is not 100% certain because it was just so long ago. But we believe that he may have been the head of the Nalanda University in Pataliputra, having been a student there, and had an astronomical observatory and was reputed to have set up an observatory as well at the Sun Temple in Tarragona, Bihar. And Aryabhata wrote several different things. Aryabhatiya is a compendium of mathematics and astronomy and was referred to in the Indian mathematical literature and survives to today. So we still have that writing from him. The Arya Siddhanta is a lost work on astronomical computations, but was referenced by his contemporaries, especially his male contemporaries specifically, and includes descriptions of several astronomical instruments. And then the final work that he's well known for is the Al-Intf or Al-Nanf, which survives and is only known in the Arabic translation. And Aryabhata insisted that the Earth rotates about its axis daily and that the movement of stars is a relative motion caused by the rotation of the Earth, not the sky rotating, as was at the time the prevailing theory. And sure, he still used geocentric model of the solar system with the moon before Mercury and the sun located between Venus and Mars in the order we now understand to exist. But he based the planetary speeds on the sun. So some say that Aryabhata's calculations are based on an underlying heliocentric model, but that has been rebutted since it wasn't explicitly heliocentric. He also did a lot of work to explain eclipses as shadows cast by and falling on the Earth. And part of that was naming that moons and planets reflect sunlight instead of just creating their own light. Sure. So that was also an interesting development in his age, and he did a lot of really careful calculations and calculated the sidereal rotation of the Earth. So that's how long it actually takes the Earth to rotate in one complete rotation. And he calculated it as 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4.1 seconds. And the current consensus is 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4.091 seconds. So he was so close.
Wow.
To what is still, like, his calculations have held close so far.
Sure.
It's very impressive. And his calculations for a sidereal year, which is how long it actually takes the Earth to go around the sun, are 365 days, 6 hours, 12 minutes, and 30 seconds, which is off by 3 minutes and 20 seconds from what we understand it to be today. So again, very, very close. Wow. For not having nearly the instruments that we have today. He, as well as many of these male astronomers, had to learn in a lot of different areas, and so also did a lot of work in mathematics and his calculation of pi, his work in trigonometry and indeterminate equations, as well as algebra. So he also did a lot of the basic trigonometry work that we were talking about as well with Hipparchus.
Yeah.
So very cool. Just a fascinating amount of knowledge and precision that he did, which is also true about the next male astronomer, who is Abu Abd Allah Muhammad Ibn Jabir Ibn Sinan Al-Raqi Al-Harani Az-Sabi Al-Battani, who is commonly known as Al-Battani. The Latinized version is Al-Battanius. So if you see that, just know that it's actually Al-Battani. And he was born in Harran in Islamic Syria in what is now known as Turkey before 858 and lived until 929 CE, Common Era. And he is considered to be the greatest of male medieval Islamic astronomers who basically kept astronomy going while Western civilization more or less imploded.
Specifically, that's the male Muslim astronomers in general and not him in particular, but he certainly helped.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating to me the ways that science and astronomy these days has so emphasized, quote-unquote, Western civilization as the source and center of astronomy when there's this whole non-Western area of astronomy that just gets super ignored. So I'm glad that we are including some of the male astronomers from that area as well. Al-Battani's meticulous recording of methods created opportunities for peer review, which is really important in science, and we'll hear a little bit more about that later. But he built on the work of male astronomer and mathematician Claudius Ptolemy in developing the geocentric model of the cosmos. He developed more precise measurements with larger astronomical instruments of greater accuracy than the male astronomer and mathematician Nicolaus Copernicus did during the Renaissance. So again, we laud, you know, Nicholas at the expense of people like Al-Battani, who were more precise and had amazing skills in astronomy and mathematics as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Al-Battani's observations of equinoxes and solstices were the most accurate at the time, including observing that the distance between the Earth and the Sun varies during the year, and figuring out why annular solar eclipses occur and are different than Claudius's predictions for when they would occur. So taking the things that, you know, most male scientists and astronomers of that time messed up and didn't know, and improving upon it.
Cool.
And then he increased the precision in measurement of the lunar crescent and like when it would appear in our skies, and the length of a solar year. So his estimation improved on Aryabhatta's so that his was off by only 2 minutes and 22 seconds. So getting closer and closer to what we now consider the time for a full solar year, which is really cool. And I'm really glad that male astronomers were paying so much attention to the time and were able to keep time for the regular people who were in their communities and families. I think it's really important that somebody keep track of that time. And then Al-Battani's book of astronomical tables was written around 900 and corrected mistakes made by Claudius and described new observational instruments, which is really cool. And the data that he collected is still used by geophysicists and astronomers today. Also in math, he contributed greatly in the use of sines and tangents in geometric calculations, again, furthering studies in trigonometry.
I've always wanted to know who to blame that on.
Al-Battani.
Yeah.
I like to know who to thank, so...
There are parts of math I love, and that is not one of them.
That's fair. That's fair. Al-Battani's family of origin belonged to the pagan Sabian sect of Haran, which is mentioned in the Quran among the people of the book. And that religion featured star worship, and they had inherited the Mesopotamian legacy of an interest in mathematics and astronomy. But as is made clear by his full name, he was Muslim. And so at some point in his life, there was some sort of conversion to Islam.
Sure. Yeah. Next up, we have Abd al-Rahman al-Sufi, who lived from 903 to 986 Common Era, and he wrote the Book of Fixed Stars, which was written in Arabic, which described almost 50 constellations and their stars, and included a very complete set of star charts with exact descriptions of those stars. It's unknown if he was married or had children, but he made the earliest recorded observation of the Andromeda Galaxy in history, and he discovered hundreds of new uses for the astrolabe as well. He also edited and added to the Almagest by Claudius that Hypatia had previously worked on. And because of the Arabic constellations and star names being unrelated but overlapping with the Greek constellations, he also spent a lot of time trying to explain and compare the two sets of names so that astronomers from either culture studying the other one would be able to understand the work of the other culture, which sounds actually super important and useful. So I'm glad a male astronomer could really spare the time for that, because I could see how that would be super confusing. Goodness knows.
Yeah, I was just going to say, he sounds a little bit like a male version of Annie Jump Cannon in the star classification.
Yeah, yeah. And also in the helping people work together thing that she was also very good at. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a ton of personal information about him. So in addition to not being clear on whether he was married or had children, we're also not very familiar with his religious life. But at a guess, living where he did and with that name, he was probably Muslim. So.
Mm-hmm.
And then next we have Tycho Brahe, who was a nobleman and the last major male astronomer before the invention of the telescope. He was in a morganatic marriage, which is a marriage from a noble person, a person with a title and lands and so forth, to a commoner. And the commoner would not be allowed to share the noble status, and their children would not be able to inherit the noble status. But they could still be married, is what a morganatic marriage is. And his wife's name was Kirsten Jorgen's daughter.
Interesting.
And they had 8 children, 6 of whom lived to adulthood. Basically, this was a love match that was allowed to happen because morganatic marriage was an option, is my understanding. And
okay,
so he discovered the supernova of the star SN1572. And if you hear someone in the background, this time it's actually Calvin, who says hello to all of our beloved listeners.
Well, hello, Calvin.
Someone apparently woke up from their nap. Okay. After he discovered that supernova, his king gave him a grant to build the first large astronomical observatory in Christian Europe. And while working on his observations at that observatory, he refuted Aristotle's theory of the unchanging celestial universe, which had been hanging around for, you know, a few thousand years at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And he was known for his vast and precise recordings of his astronomical observations, and also for losing part of his nose in a duel as a young man, therefore wearing a prosthesis for the rest of his life. It kind of sounds like that's one of those stories where we only know part of what happened, but he was a disabled scientist for most of his life. And after falling out with the next king of Denmark, the first king of Denmark gave him that observatory, the next king of Denmark, they had a disagreement, or 6, it kind of sounds like. He moved to Prague, where he built another observatory, and he spent a year working there with Johannes Kepler before his death. He was very much not a social person, like he did not like people, with the exception of the company of his wife and children, and he was also Lutheran. And his wife was the daughter of a Lutheran minister.
Interesting. I always love when we learn about people that, in fact, like someone who is the child of a Lutheran minister could have a husband who's like gets to learn things. Like,
yeah.
That's just great that and he was able to do rich. That.
Yeah. And probably got to learn things because he was super rich. That's just a theory. But yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I love it. Our next male astronomer, who you just mentioned, okay, is Johannes Kepler. And Johannes was born in 1571 in the free imperial city of Wilderstadt in the Holy Roman Empire, in what is now known as Germany. And he received a master's from the University of Tübingen in, from what I can tell, 1591. Although the records aren't particularly great because, I mean, we don't exactly know, but my guess is they only kept track of, like, the really important astronomers, and so the male astronomers just kind of, we don't always have all of the information.
That happens.
But we do have plenty of information about his family, which is really important. So Johannes was husband to Barbara Mueller, who had already been widowed twice when they met, and had a daughter named Regina Lorenz. And they together had 2 children who died in infancy, Susanna and a son, and a 3rd son who survived. And they nearly didn't succeed in getting married because of poverty. But Mueller's dad was pressured into allowing Johannes to marry Barbara.
Aww.
And I think probably it was something like the morganatic, except a little bit more complicated because he did have the title, but he didn't have money.
Yeah, that led to some interesting things.
Yeah, so that was just a fascinating thing. But in 1611, his life and his family was disrupted by illness, and the illness and eventual death of Barbara, his wife, and the illness of all 3 children and the death of the 2.
Okay.
And then he, like, took 2 years and, like, interviewed 11 people. And finally, for his second marriage, became husband to Susanna Rüttinger.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can you expand on the interviewed 11 people part of that? Because that is a heck of a way to phrase it.
Right? Like, but he, like, was looking for 2 years and, like, went through 11 different people to try and see to whom he could get married, right?
Oh, okay.
This is like the epitome of must get married now, and that like compulsion and feeling that like lots of males have, the
That's
need
true.
For stability and for family.
Especially
and that sort
for
of thing.
His first surviving child, I would imagine that's very important. Yeah.
Right? And his stepchild.
Sure.
Like, I don't know how old Regina was at that point, but yeah.
Sure.
It's important that they have two parents. And Susanna Rittinger was actually the fifth one, and he went through 11 and then came back to her. So this is one of those things where we say, like, you probably have unrealistic standards for a partner or a spouse, and he just needed to be more realistic with what he could offer in a relationship.
I mean,
so,
I think having standards is probably good, Emily.
Yes, but sometimes males just have such unrealistic standards for relationships, and they just like are so desperate to get married that...
That does happen, sure. Yes.
This marriage was less contentious. I think he probably had mellowed out a bit. But again, their first three children, Margareta, Regina, Katharina, and a son, all died in childhood.
Oh, goodness.
But Cordula and their other two sons survived into adulthood. So that was common at the time, right?
Yeah.
It was difficult to have kids and to keep them alive.
Yeah.
Much the same as it is increasingly difficult these days for particularly people who are pregnant and giving birth. So we're, you know, pretending we're going forward on things, but not always.
Yeah.
But Johannes is best known for his laws of planetary motion and influence on the male physicist Isaac Newton's theory of universal gravitation. So that's, you know, pretty cool that he got to help somebody. And he improved the design of the refracting telescope, as well as male astronomer Galileo Galilei's telescope. And he is known as a superb male mathematician and a skillful male astrologer. Astrology and astronomy were very connected back in the day. Physics was less connected to astronomy. So
yeah.
For more on astrology today, you can check out our third episode from this season with Emily Ann Garcia, who is a fantastic astrologer. And Johannes defended the heliocentric model of the universe from both a theoretical and a theological perspective. His faith was very important to him. And he observed the supernova of 1604, and his writings undermined the doctrine of the immutability of the heavens because something was created.
Yeah.
And up until that point, they kind of had this idea that nothing ever was created or destroyed or removed from
the
heavens.
Celestial universe, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And his faith was very important to him. He worked hard to precisely date the events of the life of Jesus. His main written works were Mysterium Cosmographicum, a defense of the Copernican system, Astronomia Nova, which included the first two laws of planetary motion, and the Epitome of Copernican Astronomy, which contained all three laws of planetary motion and attempted to explain heavenly motions through physical causes. And he created the Rudolphine Tables, which is a comprehensive set of specific predictions of planet and star positions in the sky. So again, similar to astronomer Annie Jump Cannon and her work in particular. And Johannes also incorporated religious arguments and reasoning into his work, motivated by his own religious convictions and his understanding that God had created the world according to an intelligible plan that is accessible through reasoning. So something that we could understand with our own reason. He wanted to become a Lutheran minister, but was in fact denied ordination because some of his beliefs, which were Calvinist and contrary to the formula of Concord.
I'm not sure that would still happen today.
I've
known some Lutheran
who knows?
Ministers with some Calvinist leanings. It's a little scary sometimes, but...
It's true. It's true. Especially with, like, male clergy, it just seems like the standards are not there as much, and so they're allowed to get away with. Yeah, we got to make sure that they keep working or whatever.
Sure.
And 1571 is right around and after the male theologian Martin Luther's big 95 Theses and all of that, and the Reformation. And so there's a lot in his life of, can he go to this place, or does he have to leave because he won't convert to Catholicism and those sorts of things. There is a controversy with Johannes. More recent scholarship has found, according to male scholar William Donahue, and I'll link to the article about this, though it is, I believe, from the New York Times, so it might be behind a paywall for you all, and I'm sorry if it is, but that's what private browsing is for. But according to William, Johannes fudged things, and his calculations regarding the elliptical orbit of Mars were actually made to fit the theory. So apparently this is not the only, like, male scientist that did this in the past. I mean,
you know, math is hard,
and
right?
Still today.
Like, not all male astronomers are good at math.
It's true. He was a white male astronomer, which also just, like, I imagine makes it that much harder, right? The other ones that we were talking about from Al-Battani and Aryabhatta, like, they were very good at precision and stuff.
Yeah, they had a real culture of scientific exploration and discovery supporting them, and that helped.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can only fault a white man so much for a lack of competency in his culture and in his time.
That happens.
So, but yes, he fudged things. And today we hold male astronomers ideally to higher standards, closer to the standards that we hold normal astronomers.
Sure. Absolutely. Okay. So in the interest of full disclosure, I will explain that this next person on my list was actually a childhood hero of mine. I read a child's biography of him at a very young age. It was one of my favorite books in my school library. And this is kind of the guy who introduced me to the idea that not only could you truly be very competently self-taught at a number of disciplines at once, but you could also use that to do very practical stuff with your life. So Benjamin Banneker, who lived from 1731 to 1806, was a African-American male astronomer and Renaissance man with very little formal schooling. He was primarily self-taught. He was born to a free African-American woman, and her husband had been formerly enslaved but was free by the time that Benjamin was born. And he never married or had children himself. He lived in Maryland in the Baltimore County area, and was perhaps best known for series of, his series of almanacs that were published over several years of his life, which he did all of his own math for his almanacs, which was actually kind of unusual because usually an almanac would be assembled by, like, multiple people doing the math, but he did everything for his own almanacs. That involved calculating lunar cycles, equinoxes and solstices, planetary movements, because he included how the planets would move during the year, and it required a whole bunch of other astronomical work. So he was a very detailed and skilled astronomer among his many other talents. He was also one of a handful of surveyors that determined the boundaries of the District of Columbia in America. Most of his work in that project being astronomical observations and calculations, which are very necessary to surveying, although these days a lot of that work is now automatically done with technology. And my favorite story about him is that at the age of 21, he had borrowed a pocket watch from somebody for a while. And while he had it with him, he took it home and he took it apart and he drew and recorded the pieces and how they all worked. And it worked when he put it back together. And then he returned it. And then after that, he built himself an all wooden mantel clock that was somewhat larger than the pocket watch, but it was based on those drawings and how all the pieces fit together. And that clock that he built for himself kept perfect time, and it kept working past the date of his death. And at the age of 21, this is the story that really caught my imagination as a child. Benjamin also corresponded with Thomas Jefferson, who he was frankly kind of unimpressed with over the course of their correspondence.
Which is not surprising. I mean, white men, they're just
so many reasons.
They're just not that impressive.
And he also did a lot of work for slavery abolition with the Quakers, but unfortunately a fire on the day of his funeral destroyed much of his personal notes and journals, so we don't actually have that many records of what he created himself. Little record of his own religious background remains. It's not really talked about in his biographies, but he was very close friends and worked quite a lot with a variety of Quakers during his life, and they were very important to him.
Nice. The fire on the day of his funeral sounds...
I have some questions, because basically his cabin that he lived in burned down that day. And so, I have some thoughts about that, but still.
Why would it, like, yeah.
I mean, it was a log cabin. It was made of wood. It was probably filled with quite a lot of paper and also wood. But still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not like that was the cause of his death. It happened after he had died.
Yeah, no, that was after his funeral.
I think especially when we're in that particular time period with such brilliant people, I think it.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the reasons why Benjamin Banneker's name continues, is that he convicted a lot of people of multiple races that, yes, black people could be mathematicians and scientists, because his work was so precise and exact.
Mm-hmm. Which, as we've established, is far less common for white men.
Sure.
They're just not as good at it. So, yeah. Also worth exploring, we did not have time to get all of them, and also, like, we just wanted to do kind of the more important ones and the ones that maybe you hadn't heard of. So also worth exploring if you are interested in more male astronomers from throughout history are Agrippa, Galileo Galilei, who also may have made up some of his experiments since they were so complicated as to not be replicable, which indicates that they might not be real. And part of the scientific process is, of course, being able to replicate experiments and check each other's work.
Well, you know, men and their imaginations.
I know. I mean, it's good to have imagination.
Yeah.
Also, Leonardo da Vinci, Nicholas Copernicus, whose work clearly was not finished, as we've already talked about people who had to make improvements and changes and edits to his work.
Sure.
And Isaac Newton, who apparently relied on quote-unquote unseemly mathematical sleight of hand in his major work to make the predictive power of his work seem greater than it was, which was a fairly common thing among white male scientists at the time, because they were trying to prove such big and important things and apparently could only do it by making some stuff up.
I also love the phrase unseemly mathematical sleight of hand. I'm going to try to keep that one in my rotation. I think that's excellent.
Yeah, I was a fan of it when I came across it too, obviously. And then also Anders Celsius and Edmund Halley are worth exploring if you're interested in male scientists.
Yeah. And then we also have a handful of honorable mentions today. James Webb was a male NASA administrator during the 1960s and oversaw a bunch of different space programs during America's early space explorations, but he was not an astronomer himself. He was also controversially possibly involved in the Lavender Scare, which were mass firings of women suspected to be lesbians in the American government agencies and military of the 1950s, but there was an extensive investigation and there's little to no hard evidence he actually participated. He was just around at that time, and it's very possible that he let some things happen without fighting them, but we don't know exactly what he did or did not do.
But as one of the male administrators would have had responsibility for.
Yeah. Like, things would have happened under that roof that he was responsible for. Let's put it that way.
And that's part of why when we talk about the latest space telescope, we use the initials JWST, or in my own circles, we call it the Justice Warrior Space Telescope, because that feels like the more appropriate thing to do.
Sure. Next, we have Carl Sagan, which is a name that many of you may be familiar with. He is well known for Contact, the book and the movie, as well as his many pop science books and his TV series Cosmos that explained a lot of astronomy to ordinary folks in the 1970s and also popularized his iconic turtleneck look. Some fellow male scientists of his time controversially did not think he himself was much of a scientist. He was much more of a communicator, really. But at least one of those scientists who weren't really impressed with his skills was his doctoral advisor's rival. So there are some questions about that source, because that guy already had a bone to pick. And then lastly, we have Stephen Hawking, who was a male physicist and cosmologist who spent a lot of his time on astrophysics, but also was not exactly an astronomer himself. Controversially, his text-to-speech computer, which you may know of because of his physical disabilities, it originally did not come with any British accented voices. And so he used an American voice to start out with. And then later, I believe, well over a decade and possibly closer to 2 decades later, because it took a while, because this was, you know, a few decades ago, when someone finally made him a British voice, and I believe they specifically made one for Stephen Hawking himself. He had actually grown so attached to the voice he had been using for decades already that he kept it anyway. And so he kept an American accent despite being British.
Like you do.
Apparently there are some British people that have feelings about that. So
understandable. Understandable. Yeah. And then moving into more contemporary times with male astronomers, just as a note, we did have more historical male astronomers than modern ones compared to last week's astronomers that had some more new ones, just because they're just a little bit harder to find nowadays. That they, sure. I think they had some advantages back in the day, male astronomers did, that made them more well-known compared to male astronomers today.
Yeah.
So our first one for the more contemporary male astronomers is Jan Hendrik Oort, who was born in Franeker, Friesland in the Netherlands in 1900 and received his doctorate from Groningen with a thesis on the properties of high-velocity stars. And importantly, Jan was the husband of Johanna Maria Grot von Rogen, and the father to 3 children, a daughter, Marika, and 2 sons. Jan built on male Swedish astronomer Bertil Lindblad's work to demonstrate through observation that the galaxy did rotate and that the farther out stars were, the slower they rotated, and that, in fact, the sun was 30,000 light years from the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And he concluded with fellow male astronomer Nicholas Mayle that the Crab Nebula was the result of a supernova explosion. Jan moved with his family to a quiet village in the province of Gelderland after the Nazis invaded the Netherlands in order to avoid being forced to collaborate with them. Although the university he was working at the time, Leiden University, was integral to the resistance, particularly a speech given by male dean of the Faculty of Law, Rudolf Cleveringa, which he gave when Nazis took over and fired all of the Jewish faculty, including a faculty from the School of Law.
Hmm.
And so Jan, in order to avoid collaborating or being sent to a concentration camp, disappeared into the country with his family. And he led radio astronomy in the Netherlands and the mapping of the Milky Way with the use of radar equipment left behind by the Germans, which is an interesting thing that we don't always talk about. What happens to technology after wars? And in the United States, we know that we mainly use it for violence. But that was a really cool, like, using the radar equipment to be one of the first male astronomers, especially to start to figure out that there's this other way of observing the universe, which now we know as the cosmic background radiation. And Jan hypothesized the existence of what is now known as the Oort cloud. And in our solar system episode, we talked about it as the Oort cloud because we didn't know better, and now we know better, so we're doing better. Ernst Oppik was a male Estonian astronomer, and he proposed a reservoir of long-period comets in the form of an orbiting cloud at the outermost edge of the solar system. And then Jan came along and revived the idea much later in 1950 and gets most of the credit for that discovery, which is part of why we've adjusted the name to recognize the person who first discovered it and then the person who made it popular, because it's important. So the Oort cloud and Ernst Oppik as an Estonian male astronomer, which I think is a really cool thing because we get so set in where we think good astronomers can come from.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Jan is also credited for being the first to find evidence for dark matter in 1932 by measuring the motions of stars in the Milky Way. He found the mass of the galactic plane must be more than the mass of what was observed, but the measurement was later determined to be erroneous, as is known to happen with male astronomers, as we're noticing this pattern, right? And Vera Rubin, who we mentioned last week, remains one of the key astronomers in the discovery and establishment of dark matter as a real thing. And Jan came from a family with lots of male clergy, including founders of the more liberal church in Holland, and one of his male ancestors, I believe, made a new translation of the Bible into Dutch. And he is one of 5 children. His 2 sisters were younger than him, and he had 2 brothers.
Cool. Next, we have Gerard Kuiper, who was born in 1905 and died in 1973. And he was a male astronomer who was also often called the father of planetary science. He married Sarah Parker Fuller in 1933, although I couldn't discover if they had children. And the Kuiper Belt is named after him, although he didn't discover it himself. He studied at Leiden University in the Netherlands and received his doctorate from there in 1933 with a thesis on binary stars. And after this, he moved to America, where he wound up at Harvard, and then later the University of Chicago, where he would later be the doctoral advisor to male astronomer Carl Sagan, who we already mentioned. He also, during World War II, served in the American military, and personally, with some help, rescued male scientist Max Planck and his wife from being captured by the Soviets. It was apparently a very exciting story. And he discovered a moon of Uranus and a moon of Neptune. And eventually, in, I think, 1960, he moved to the University of Arizona, where he helped identify potential landing sites on the moon for the Apollo program. And most of his astronomical work during his life focused on observing planets, like when he found carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of Mars. And he specifically focused a lot on observations of the moon and the moon's surface. But he also discovered several binary stars. Controversially, he had a nasty falling out with his colleague Harold Urey over theories about the temperature of the moon's core. This is also the same guy who was not super impressed with Carl Sagan, but again, since Kuiper was Sagan's doctoral advisor, there might have been some overlap in this guy's feelings about the two of them. And also, he worked on Project A-119, which was not something I was previously familiar with, but apparently the Air Force had a plan during the 1950s to detonate a nuclear bomb on the moon in order to better study the fallout of a nuclear blast and also as a show of force to the world. And apparently that got canceled because they figured out that, you know, landing some people on the moon and bringing them back would be a better PR move for them, which I hope that wasn't difficult for them to figure out, but these were, you know, male astronomers figuring that kind of thing out and male Air Force officers, and maybe they just took a little extra time.
I just think males are so
emotional.
They just are so uneducated about the importance of discovery and the value of the environment and
not,
I mean,
murdering.
Really, it's amazing that they function at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our next scientist is Edwin Powell Hubble. And Edwin wouldn't be a name we know without the amazing work of astronomer Nancy Grace Roman. Though we didn't mention her in our last episode, she is definitely worth mentioning. She was born in 1925 in Nashville, Tennessee, and got her doctorate in astronomy from the University of Chicago in 1949. She created NASA's space-based astronomy program, and by 1960 was chief of astronomy and relativity, known as the parent of Hubble. She is also in the Women of NASA Lego set, which is cool.
I'm sorry, there's a Women of NASA Lego set? Oh my goodness, why did no one tell this to me? How dare you all keep this from me for this long? I object.
Right? I think Sally Ride is also in it.
Oh my goodness, and her fabulous hair.
And
sorry.
Right. Yes. And the next flagship mission from NASA is named for Nancy Grace Roman.
Aww.
Yeah. So the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope will explore questions regarding dark energy, exoplanets, and infrared astrophysics.
Awesome.
So she is fantastic. And we have her to thank for anything we know about the male astronomer Edwin Powell Hubble. And Edwin was born in 1889 in Marshfield, Missouri, and received his PhD in 1921 from the University of Chicago for photographic investigations of faint nebulae. And thanks to the incredible work of astronomer Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who we talked about last week in discovering the standard candle measurement and Cepheid variables, Cepheids with radial velocity, and so variation in luminosity is what we mean by that. Thanks to their very important work, Edwin was able to discover Cepheid variables in the Andromeda and Triangulum nebulae, proving that they are galaxies and that the universe is much more than just the Milky Way galaxy. And this was hypothesized by male philosopher Immanuel Kant in 1755. Huh. And Edwin was raised as a Protestant Christian, but may have moved toward agnosticism in later life. It's not completely clear. Hmm. And one of the controversies for Edwin is that Georges Henri Joseph Edouard Lemaître, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. I'm sorry, my French is terrible. Was a male Belgian Catholic priest whose work in the expansion rates of the universe led to the discovery of what is called either Hubble's Law or Hubble-Lemaître Law. And George's work was published 2 years before Edwin's, but in French. And so because Edwin published in English and racism and the Anglocentrism, I guess.
Yeah.
The law for a long time was just attributed to Edwin.
Yeah.
So again, there's this, you know, there's so many controversies around male astronomers. I don't know.
So our next astronomer is Kip Stephen Thorne, who was born in 1940 and who is the first male astronomer on our list so far who has not yet died. Oh. And he was actually a male astrophysicist and a theoretical physicist, and he's focused mostly on gravitational physics during his career, as well as relativistic stars. Relativistic stars are stars where the movements are explained by general relativity, but not explained by Newtonian physics. Like, basically, you have to have general relativity as part of your toolbox in order to understand why and how they move. And also, he works extensively on black holes. He married Linda Jean Peterson, with whom he's father to Karis and Brett, and they later divorced, and then he married Carolee Joyce Winstein later on. He received his doctorate from Princeton in 1965, and he's well known for his mentorship of young physicists over the course of his career, and also his ability to convey the exciting aspects of scientific discoveries to the general public. Much of his earlier work helped develop the ways to detect gravitational waves. Again, he was very into gravity. And you can also see our recent episode on astrophysics with Dr. Katie Mack for more background on all that.
Mm-hmm. She had so much wisdom and knowledge about all so of that. Things. Gravitational waves, dark matter, dark energy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great astrophysicist.
And a lot of his work regarding gravitational waves and their detection was through the LIGO project, I think is how you pronounce it, L-I-G-O, which he helped to found. He was raised in the Church of the Latter-day Saints, but he is now an atheist. But he also has publicly said that there is no contradiction in the concept of scientists having faith. And controversially, he does have a theory that wormholes could be useful for time travel, but specifically, probably only for traveling forwards in time, not for traveling backwards in time. Hmm. There's a more detailed explanation of that, but I didn't think that that's what we were really talking about today. So,
yeah, interesting. And then our next male astronomer for this episode is Mike Brown, who I have talked about before because, well, we'll get to it, but that's not the most important. Most importantly, he is husband to Diane Binney and father to Lila. He was born in Huntsville, Alabama in 1965 and received his PhD in astronomy from the University of California at Berkeley in 1994. And so Mike wrote the book, How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming, which, as you all know by now, I read and quite enjoyed, actually. It's a really great book for a male astronomer on science and life and his family life. Of course, it's a memoir because the real hard science books we'll leave to the professionals, if you will. But you can find that linked in our episode description to our bookshop.org shop, where it'll be listed. And if you are interested in buying it, you can buy it and give us some number of coins, incidental, as well as Red Emma's, which is a local coffee shop bookshop in Baltimore. And Mike co-discovered with Chad Trujillo and sometimes David Rabinowitz the possible dwarf planets Quawar, Sedna, Orcus, Eris being the only known trans-Neptunian object, shout out to all the trans folks out there, including Pluto, that is more massive than Pluto. Haumea, which was a controversial discovery, and Makemake. He has discovered 29 minor planets, not counting Haumea, including Eris, who was also the reason that Pluto was demoted, as we talked about in our solar system episode. And Sedna is possibly the first known inner Opic Oort cloud object, which is pretty cool. And with male astronomer Konstantin Batygin, Mike proposed the existence of a ninth major planet between the size of Earth and Neptune. So pretty significant size. And now for Haumea. The male scientists, Chad Trujillo and David Rabinowitz, were part of this, but a lot of it kind of focuses on Mike as the male lead for the project. Haumea's discovery was initially credited to José Luis Ortiz Moreno, a male scientist in Spain, and his team, which included his male doctoral student, Pablo Santos Sanz, and that discovery was located at the Sierra Nevada Observatory in Granada, Spain. And the announcement, which is how credit for discovery happens in planetary science, came suspiciously close to the announcement of papers being presented by Chad and David that referred to Haumea by its initial classification name. And those papers were part of Mike's plan to announce the discovery. And it is likely that what happened was José Luis's team Googled the object mentioned in Chad and David's papers, looked up the information for where it was via information that was unfortunately public and easy to like hack and figure out on the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory in Chile, where they had been tracking it. And from those calculations, figured out where it was, how to find it easily, which is not cool in the scientific world and not part of the way
that skates suspiciously close
scientific discovery should happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the naming of Haumea was actually delayed for a really long time because the International Astronomical Union didn't really want to weigh in on the controversy, even though, and Mike, from his account, started out and was giving full credit and was just like really disappointed that they didn't get the announcement out in time. And other people were very suspicious. And like many males, he was just a little bit naive. And so like was giving credit where credit is due as much as he could. And then finally was like, okay, too many things, fed it up. And so kind of went public with what he knew about the controversy. And then when names were being put forward, the way it works in the International Astronomical Union is that the team of people who discover the object get to submit a name for the object. It's not always 100% going to be that name, but they are the only ones that can submit a name. And so both teams submitted a name. And the IAU, the way they played it out was they did not credit anyone for the discovery, but they did say that it was discovered in Spain. And then they used the name Haumea, which was the name proposed by Mike's team. So they tried to like
even
cover all their bases.
Sure.
When rather than being clear about what was going on.
Sure.
So it's, you know, typical politics that, like, males get into all of this, like, bickering and politicking and those sorts of things.
Yeah, it happens a lot.
Male scientists. Yeah. So.
And then we have Neil deGrasse Tyson, who was born in 1958. And he is a male astronomer who has done extensive work in the study of stars, galaxies, and also cosmology, but he is actually best known as a male science communicator and an expert in science for the media because, frankly, it's kind of rare for males to be so good at communicating, as many of us may have personal experience with. But
it's true, it's true.
So we tend to notice the ones that are good at it, at least when it comes to science. I don't know about his personal life. Speaking of his personal life, he's married to Alice Young and father to Miranda and Travis. And he is known for his podcast Star Talk and his restart of the series Cosmos that was originally done by Carl Sagan, as well as writing several well-known pop science books. He coined the term Manhattanhenge for the day when the sunrise or sunset lines up most perfectly with the Manhattan East and West streets so that the sunlight basically shines all the way across the city, which is apparently a super exciting thing to see, and also kind of blinding depending on what the weather's like. And he has spoken extensively in favor of gay and trans rights over the course of his career, as well as the struggles that women and racial minorities face in the sciences. But these days, he prefers to be interviewed on topics other than race. And he specifically cites a interview that he did in 1989 about astronomy that was the first time where he was basically his own first experience of a Black person being interviewed on television about something other than race. Like, his first experience of that was himself being interviewed on TV in 1989. And he was amazed at the concept of a Black person talking on TV about something other than race, and so he decided he wanted to do more of that, which seems fair. Yeah. He was raised Catholic and is now agnostic, although there's this whole thing on his Wikipedia page about how he keeps claiming that atheists keep saying that he's an atheist, but actually he's agnostic, and he keeps having to fight back on that.
I mean, I can't blame him. It's hard for males to make up their mind.
Sure, and labels are important, absolutely. Now, controversially, he was accused of sexual misconduct in 2018 by four women, and his podcast and also the Cosmos series were both suspended due to these allegations. And on a much lighter, although still controversial note, he became known as something of a, I don't know that there's a particular term for this, but I think of it as being a fun ruiner on Twitter for several years. I don't know how else to describe it. But he would basically show up in non-science conversations and tell people that they shouldn't be enjoying things that they enjoy. I personally witnessed this on a number of occasions. And that's just explains so much about social media and also male communication techniques. But why do you have to spend your time like that?
Yeah. Also, there is some controversy from his partnership with Autism Speaks briefly.
Yeah.
For some episodes he did around autism, which is also a thing. Yeah. But yeah. And then our final male astronomer for this episode is Chad Trujillo, who we mentioned in our solar system episode, I believe. He was born in 1973 and received his PhD in 2000 from the University of Hawaii. And for both Chad and Edwin, we didn't have as much information about their family lives. So they're just kind of like more private people. So we don't know those important things about who they are in their life. But Chad is co-discoverer with Mike Brown of Eris, the most massive dwarf planet known in the solar system. And he studies the Kuiper Belt and outer solar system. And he has discovered or co-discovered 57 minor planets, including many trans-Neptunian objects from the Kuiper Belt. So a lot of his work is connected to Mike's. That's just kind of how it is. But yeah, it's really cool to see how different. And we've had this a couple times, right? The importance of being able to find a mentor
who is that like actually you. Works.
And a partnership, yeah.
Finding someone you can work with is good, yeah.
Yeah, like it would be nice if they could do this on their own, like other astronomers, but it's also good that they have that support that they need,
absolutely,
clearly, to make it work as male astronomers. And one controversial thing, so as I mentioned, he got his PhD from the University of Hawaii, and much of Chad and Mike's work, especially earlier on, was based on observations from Mauna Kea, the Mauna Kea Observatory in Hawaii, or utilized them. And Mauna Kea is a really important part of Hawaiian culture and cosmology. In Hawaiian cosmology, Mauna Kea is the center of the entire universe, the place where Earth Mother and Father Sky meet, and home of the gods and the fount of existence. And so to have increasing numbers of telescopes on Mauna Kea without the concern that is vital for the environment and for the culture and the importance of Mauna Kea itself is a big deal. So when the building of the latest mammoth 30-meter telescope, very creatively named, we know, TMT, was approved by the courts, several protectors of Mauna Kea, including Noe Noe Wong Wilson, were arrested protesting the resumed construction. They did a lot of different actions, including roadblocks, arrests, and establishing an encampment near the access road so that they could continue to have a presence there. And there was a manufactured urgency about building the telescope because of competition with the other, also creatively named, European Extremely Large Telescope, ELT, and wanting to kind of one-up them. So not an urgency because it was urgent, but because they wanted to best somebody else.
Wait, an overly competitive nature of male astronomers? Huh, I never would have guessed.
Yeah. Unsurprising, and the inability to recognize the importance of other scientific and cultural aspects for the pursuit of their own thing is, I mean, we talk about like having a tunnel vision, but it's almost like all they could see out of was like a telescope. Yeah. Nothing at all around them, just very far off. So a law was passed, actually, and we have an article from 2022 on this that'll give you kind of more of an overview, but control of Mauna Kea's summit is actually shifting from 2023 to 2028. There's a 5-year period of shifting the control of the summit from the University of Hawaii into the hands of an 11-member oversight authority, okay, which includes Native Hawaiians, cultural practitioners, and representatives of the state and other institutions. So I at least am hopeful that this helps address some of the fundamental injustices connected to the ways that male astronomers have used and abused that place and kind of ignored or run rampant on the cultural history and the needs of the land itself. But we shall see.
Yeah.
For now, the building of the 30-meter telescope is paused because of pandemic and protests and other things. So we're at a bit of a like good spot to be shifting control so that if the construction continues, it will be done well.
Yeah.
In a holistic sense.
So we do have a couple quick mentions for our male astronomers in pop culture section. First off, of course, we have Bill Nye the Science Guy, who was a major part of many of our childhoods.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Bill. And he did astronomy along with many, many other types of science. I thought about bringing him up in honorable mentions, but really his existence is more in pop culture because he affected so many children's lives. Calvin has also briefly rejoined us. We'll see how long he decides to stay or whether he decides to speak up. And we are grateful for Bill Nye's hard work in explaining science to children around the country and the world.
Mm-hmm. I remember watching Bill Nye. Also, he was on Big Bang Theory, which has other male space scientists also in pop culture. I forgot about them. Ah, white men. They're so forgettable. Another and probably my favorite pop culture mention of male astronomers is, of course, the song Galileo by the Indigo Girls, which I love and is fantastic. And yes, they talk about Galileo's head was on the block. Crime was looking up the truth. Mm. So I love them. Like they do such a great job of incorporating faith and spirituality and culture and science.
Yeah.
And
then of course we have a popular and well-known fictional male astronomer, Marvin the Martian, who really loved his telescope and who performed many important scientific experiments, most of which were going to hopefully end with an earth-shattering kaboom. Sadly, he did not get quite as many of those as he had hoped, but the mental image of Marvin with his telescope is one that will stay with me for life.
I love it. I did not know that Marvin was male. It's good to have a male representing that category.
Yeah. And then, of course, we have our Bible readings on astronomy for this episode.
Mm-hmm. Our first reading is from Genesis chapter 26, verses 1 through 5. God's promise to Isaac about descendants and stars. I really like this passage. I'm going to talk about the ways that this passage kind of gives us a really accurate picture of the potential harm of people and faith and science.
Mm.
So in verse 3, we read, God says, "Reside in this land as an alien, and I will be with you and will bless you." And God is talking to Isaac, and this just reminded me of the Mauna Kea controversy and the ways that science, even astronomy, and maybe even especially space exploration is tied into colonization and is frequently buried or hidden, right? So when astronomers are trying to build telescopes at the highest up, most remote in terms of light pollution traffic places,
yeah,
they're frequently the sacred places for indigenous people. And there is a sense in which science is held up as this like pure and pristine thing. And yet it is also implicated in harm that is caused in the name of science, just as in this case, God is giving this land that is already inhabited to Isaac.
Also, like and by now, we genuinely know how to legit launch satellites into orbit. So maybe we could use those instead. Just a thought.
You know. Yeah, but I do think it's a thing for Isaac and Rebecca.
Yeah.
And for Rebecca and Isaac and their
And then in verse 4, we read, I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars of heaven. And okay, this passage is in the Hebrew scriptures. And so I think that this is implying the sky when it's talking about heaven, rather than the New Testament concept of heaven as the afterlife. Am I right, no, Emily?
They're talking about sky. You're right.
Yeah. Yes. And but because of the way that it's translated into English, I am now intrigued by the concept of heaven, as in the afterlife, having different stars and constellations than the ones we currently see. Right. And of course, the New Earth and New Jerusalem might have new stars, too. And so that just sounds super interesting to me. And I wonder what those would be like.
Interesting.
Huh. Yeah. And then our second reading for this episode is Job chapter 9, verses 7 through 9. These verses give credit to God as the original astronomer who created the stars in the first place. Also, we're not getting into it, but if you want to jump over to Job chapter 38, verses 31 through 33, this kind of retreads those verses, but also has God pointing out that Job didn't, you know, do any of that. And so maybe Job should listen to God more.
Yeah. And the link that we have for the readings will include Job 38 as well.
Yeah.
I was looking at this, especially at verse 7, who commands the sun and it does not rise, who seals up the stars. Of course, God referring to God's self. And I am really excited for the way the sun rises and is hidden that is coming up with the eclipse on April 8th. So our house is debating doing the drive to go check it out. We'll see if we end up doing it or not. But if you are in the path of the eclipse or planning to be in the path of the eclipse on April 8th, let us know. We would love to know who is out there safely watching the
eclipse. Yeah, with proper eye protection.
Yes.
And then also, I love verse 9, which says that God spent a lot of time painting pretty pictures in the sky, which is to say the constellations with all those stars. And so you better give God credit for all that work, because there is no AI artwork plagiarism here. Thank you very much.
I love that.
Yeah.
Also, with that verse, shout out to the lesbian car mascot Subaru, which is the Japanese name for the constellation we know in English as Pleiades. And now it's time for our Muppets moment.
Yay!
And our question for this Muppets moment is, which Muppet do you want to visit Bill Nye? And perhaps, additionally, what would they be exploring?
Okay, so I want to be clear. I do not mean to steal your choices. If any of these guys are the folks that you want to have visit Bill Nye, you by all means go for it. But like my original thought was, you know, well, of the male Muppets who would want to visit a male scientist, I suppose Scooter would be like super organized and have a list of questions ready, or like Kermit would be so enthusiastic about going there with a fabulous sense of wonder and discovery, and that would be great. But really, I think the Muppet I want to go visit Bill Nye is Fozzie Bear, because like Bill is so often stuck with the role of being the entertainer. And while he's good at it, really, I think he deserves to have someone come and make the jokes for him, and that he deserves to have a good time too. And so I want Fozzie Bear to go. And I think that whatever that they are exploring together, it should be something with a lot of opportunity for physical comedy and like slapstick. And so I'm thinking chemistry with lots of like bubbling over potions and possibly some minor explosions and things like that.
That's fantastic. I forgot that we were doing males, and I was like, I mean, of course, it's not
necessarily the first thing that comes to mind. That's true.
Right. Yeah. It's hard to, sometimes it's just hard to think of male Muppets and male astronomers and males really at all. So I was initially thinking Elmo, because I think Elmo and Bill would have a blast. But now I'm like working on rethinking that and trying to think of who actually are male Muppets. I think I would love for the male Muppet, Ernie, to visit Bill Nye.
Oh, sure.
I think they would have a blast. I think, I mean, I'm also thinking, like, of the science around water and baths and soap and that sort of thing, so that Rubber Ducky could also come.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think that they would just have a blast and get to, like, sing some songs and that sort of a thing. And I think there are ways that I think Ernie also might be open to this, to, like, kind of astronomy, more astronomy stuff. I think Bert would be really interested in astronomy, actually.
Sure. He
strikes me as one of those male Muppets that would be into the stars.
Well, and also, now that I think about it, a lot of Bert and Ernie's time on Sesame Street was Ernie doing something and Bert being the journalist reporting the story. And that would allow, like, Ernie to be in the middle of the science happening and all of the stuff going on. And it would allow Bert to have a little extra space, because he's not really so much a in the middle of the chaos kind of guy. And I could see that working out really well for both of them.
Yeah. And I think it's a lot of work for a male Muppet to do. So I think having, like, two of them there to do that work is probably probably necessary. I don't think one would be able to.
Again, like, allowing those partnerships that they have to form in order to be able to do all of the things they need to get done, to allowing those partnerships to shine is really important.
It's true. It's true.
Well, great. Thanks for joining us. Our theme music was by Rachel Meyer Lachlan, and our Muppets music was by Brenda Boss, and our seasonal artwork was by Pace Warfield. Catch us next time when we'll dive into geography and celestial navigation. This podcast has been produced by us, Kay Roloff and Emily Ewing. For more fun, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Blue Sky at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts, now including iHeartRadio and the Amazon stuff, because you gotta do what you gotta do, plus the Our Bible app and other places. If you want access to our uncut episodes, merch discounts, movie commentaries, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. Starting at just $5 per month, it's cheaper than going through all of the fudging of statistics and scientific experiments that male astronomers apparently have to do to get anything by in science.
And make themselves look competent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a shame. Also, let us know on Blue Sky, Facebook, or Twitter, which Muppet would you like to have visit Bill Nye, and what should they be studying?
As the ancient Christian said,
Pax vobiscum.